Hello, welcome. Tonight we're going to start our two units on negotiable instruments, better known as commercial paper. And we're going to break that down, as we said, into two classes, six lectures on that. Remember that last time we discussed the world of torts. We talked about general principles and the difference between a tort and a crime and how they often intersect. Most crimes are torts, and most torts are crimes. The tort is the private relief from that, where you would get a recovery from the criminal conduct or the tortious conduct in civil court. And the crime side is when society in general prosecutes the person who did the wrong. We talked about types of torts and the differences between torts. And then we moved into intentional torts versus negligence. What you need to do, remember the intent standard for a tort is not that you intended the consequences, but you merely intended the act which caused the consequences. And with respect to negligence, you need to show the duty, the breach of duty, the harm, the causation, and the foreseeability. And then lastly, we discussed liability and foreseeability. Remember, liability is determined by a jury with torts. They determine the question of liability, and then they get into the question of damages. And in order for a tort to have occurred, not only does there have to be the duty and breach of duty and the harm and the causation, but there's got to be foreseeability. The person who was the defendant had to be able to have a understanding that their activities would have caused the injury to the plaintiff. We discussed very briefly the strict liability elements. Those are either generally under statute, that certain torts are strict liability, whereby they don't have to prove all those elements of negligence. If you did the act, guess what? Then you're strictly liable. And then lastly, we talked about defenses for liability to torts, and how the defendant can sometimes raise a defense that they're not responsible for that. And those include things like statute of limitations or comparative negligence. And lastly, we did the very famous case of McPherson versus Buick on the issue of foreseeability. And remember, that was the case of the car wheel breaking because of the fact that Buick didn't properly inspect it. And had they been able to do that, Mr. McPherson, who was a stone cutter, wouldn't have been thrown from the car in the accident when the wheel collapsed. And Justice Cardozo found that wheel should have been inspected, and he found that because of that, it was foreseeable that a reasonable inspection and it was a product liability action. And remember, also coming out of that case was the fact that anyone in the chain of commerce could be found to be liable for that, not just the dealer, not just the manufacturer of the wheel, but also the manufacturer of the car. So tonight we're going to enter into a two-part series of lectures, the first three tonight and then the next three next time, on what we call negotiable instruments or commercial paper. The two terms are used interchangeably. And what are negotiable instruments? That's what we're going to kick off tonight, definitions and types of negotiable instruments and the parties to them. Then we're going to talk about the concept of negotiability. That means the transfer offer of the negotiable instrument. We're going to talk about definitions and the requirements to make that instrument negotiable. Then we're going to talk about factors in language and statute of limitations. And last, we're going to wrap up with problems and warranties. What does it mean for transfer? What's the effect of that? The process of negotiation. What happens when you have a forgery? What happens when you have endorsements and things of that nature? So, and lastly, we're going to do our case, which talks about the elements of commercial paper, what makes commercial paper something that is important in our society, and it has been transformed. You know, traditionally, when I went to law school, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, it was physical paper. And today, much of transfer of money, and we're going to get into this in our second series of lectures, is done electronically. We start off with the actual paper documents so that you know what they are, because when they're converted over into electronic form, that way you have a basic understanding before it gets converted over that. It's kind of like learning to write and then learning to type on a computer. So you know what you need to know what the letters are and how to make them with a pen before you know how to type it on a keyboard. So let's get into our introduction. There are a little bit of a forewarning. This is somewhat complex, but we're going to try and make it as simple as we can so that you can bring it with you. We're not going to delve in so deep that, you know, you need a life preserver. So we're going to try and make this as simple as possible and straightforward as possible. But rest assured that negotiable instruments is one of the hardest classes in law school. And we're going to try and simplify it so that it is something that's understandable, that you kind of take a basic survey understanding by the time you get through these two classes. Okay, we'll see. Let's jump right in. First thing is definitions. What is a negotiable instrument? Well, negotiable instruments, like much of what we've been talking about recently, is defined in the Uniform Commercial Code. The Uniform Commercial Code is a state statute. It's the New York State Uniform Commercial Code. It was adopted from a group of statutes that have been a model that was produced out by a bunch of professors and scholars and a committee, basically, in the late 1950s, early 1960s, that would provide a standard for commercial law. And when we say commercial law, that's laws that affect business transactions. So, you know, we talked much about Article 2, which is the contract article. Now we're talking about Article 3, which is the negotiable instruments sections. And the Article 3 really defines what these negotiable instruments are and how they're used. Now, we cite the Uniform Commercial Code in a lot of standards. You know, when we talk about contract law is as old as common law, and most of the provisions of the UCC dealing with commercial contracts. It's, you know, obviously contract law is far broader than just sales contracts, and that's what the UCC deals with. But with respect to contracts, it's a much broader area. So we have dealt with that, and our previous lectures have talked about that. When it comes to negotiable instruments, we focus more on this Article 3 of the UCC because it provides a lot of these definitions. And as a result of that, the Uniform Commercial Code, which newly revised, as I said, it came out, revised in the 19, 50s and 60s, and it has been revised since. But it has been around for well over 100 years as far as these principles that are contained within there. And it is something that really came about after the Industrial Revolution, whereby you have to have some kind of substitute for money. That's what a negotiable instrument really is. It's a substitute for money, because people don't want to be carrying around excessive amounts of cash, particularly in business transactions. And if they use this negotiable instrument, and we'll talk about what is a negotiable instrument, but primarily, if you think of it as a substitute for cash, then it becomes much more easily understandable and helpful. And they take four forms, and we'll get to that in a minute. But let's just talk about what is the definition under the UCC. And the UCC defines a negotiable instrument as a unconditional promise or order to pay a fixed amount of money that is payable to bearer or order. When we say payable to order, that is to a specific person or entity. Okay. So if I make it payable to Jim Jones, or payable to the Polaroid Corporation, that's to order. If I make it payable to bearer, and you don't use the term bearer when you write out the negotiable instrument, you either leave the payee blank, or you put cash or some other designation that it's anybody. It's whoever has possession of that negotiable instrument. So it's got to be an unconditional promise or order to pay a fixed amount of money to either the person who has possession of the instrument, or to a specific person or entity. It's got to be payable on demand or at a definite time. So it's payable when I present it, that's on demand, or at a definite time, March 31st. Okay. And it does not state any instruction other than the payment of money. So those three things have to be part of the commercial paper in order to make it a negotiable instrument. So it's got to be an unconditional promise. That means it can't have any other conditions. It could be an order or a promise, one or the other. Order is pay this money. Promise is I'll pay this money. Okay. Basically, it's a cash substitute. And a simple definition is a negotiable instrument is a record. It's got to be in writing. That's one of the provisions of it. Of a signed promise or order to pay a specified sum of money. Simple as that. It's a cash substitute. That's what you're going to think of it as. Now, what's the purpose of negotiable instruments? The overall purpose of negotiable instruments is for convenience and ease of transfer of money. They're a way to facilitate financial transactions and payment. It's a way to conduct business so that businesses can make and accept certain kinds of paper, which we refer to as commercial paper, in order to obtain that payment or to make that payment. As we said, it's a money substitute. Commercial paper is accepted as a substitute for money or as a means for offering credit. Negotiable commercial paper is therefore created and accepted for the purpose of facilitating the transfer of funds and payment in business transactions. It's as simple as that. Now, what are the types of negotiable instruments? They do one of two things, as our definitions just discussed. First, it's a promise to pay a certain type of or a certain amount of money. The promises to pay are one of two types of negotiable instruments. They are promissory notes and certificates of deposit. Orders to pay are drafts and checks. So you have promises to pay, promissory notes, and certificates of deposits, often, by the way, called CDs. And orders to pay are drafts and checks. Let's go into each one of these things. What's a promissory note? A promissory note is a promise to pay. And a promissory note is a written promise. All these have to be in writing. It's a written promise made and signed by the maker. That's the person who creates it. To pay a sum certain in money to the holder of the instrument. A holder is the person who has physical custody of it. A promissory note is an unconditional promise, and it's in writing made by one person to another. Signed by the maker to pay on demand or at a definite time, a sum certain to order or bearer. Remember, order is a specifically named person, bearer, whoever is in possession of the note. What's a certificate of deposit as opposed to a promissory note? Both of them are promises to pay. A CD, however, is a promise to pay by a bank. It's a specific promissory note, not done by an individual or a corporation. It's done by a bank. Basically, you give a bank money and it gives you the certificate of deposit saying, hey, you deposited with me X dollars and I'm going to pay you X dollars at a specified time. The certificate of deposit is a promise to pay instrument issued by a bank. A promissory note is not issued by a bank. Only difference. It's issued by a person or a corporation or somebody else. Okay. Now, what are orders to pay? The first type of order to pay is called a draft. A draft is an order by one party to pay a sum of money to another party. And they're directing a third party to pay it. So if I direct my company to pay you for a certain sum, that is a draft. A draft is not on a bank. A draft is on a third party, not a bank. It's by one person upon another, signed by the person giving it, and ordering the person to whom it is directed to pay on demand or definite time an amount certain in money to order or bear. What's a check? A check is a draft. Just like a CD is a promissory note issued by a bank, a check is a draft issued by a bank. A check is a draft, other than a documentary draft, that's payable on demand and drawn on a bank. Whereas a simple draft is paid by the person who it is directed to be paid by. A check is directed to be paid by the bank from a certain account. An account which the drawer, better known as the depositor, has in the bank. The drawee is the bank, and they will pay that to the payee. Now, an ordinary check, as pictured here, is a check that is drawn on a depositor's account. It is made by the depositor out to a third party who's the payee. It's drawn on that depositor's account to be paid out by the bank. Now, what is a cashier's check? A cashier's check also comes from a bank, but that is a check that is drawn by the bank itself. It comes out of bank funds, not a depositor's fund. Generally, you have to give money to the bank to have them give you a cashier's check. To give you an example, and you have to pay them not only the amount that is on the check, but usually some kind of surplus beyond that for their processing of it. Generally not a huge amount, but some degree. So generally, why do I want a cashier's check? It's a guaranteed payment. The bank is the one who has the money in the account, and that's far more certain than having somebody give you a personal or ordinary check. So when I turn around, I'll give you an example. I'm going to do a house closing for my parents. They're selling their home. And when we get a check for the payment of that sale of that home, they're going to give us a cashier's check. I don't want a personal check because I have no guarantee that that person has that amount of money in their account. I'm going to get a cashier's check from the purchasers in the amount that we're selling the house for. And they're going to give us that bank check, that cashier's check, in the amount of the sale, because I know that the funds are going to be in that bank. And since it's in excess of $200,000, we're going to want to make sure that those funds are there. That's a cashier's check. A cashier's check is different than a teller's check. A teller's check is kind of an individual, unusual document, which is a draft drawn by a bank on another bank. It's basically, instead of you giving a personal check drawn on your bank, that teller will give you a check drawn on another bank. That's usually done between banks. It's not generally something that is in a context of individual consumers. A traveler's check is something that is issued that's payable on demand. It's countersigned by the person. It's generally you buy them when you're traveling so that you can cash them. I'll give you an example. American Express is big in traveler's check. So when you go to Europe, you can cash this check and those people know that the funds are there. They're kind of antiquated because most people today use credit cards instead of traveler's checks. They used to be very popular before the age of credit cards because of the fact that the people would know that this national company would be able to pay the amount of the check rather than having to take your personal check from a bank very far away that they didn't know or trust. Lastly, a money order can also be a check, but it doesn't have to be. A money order that's drawn on a bank is a check, but a money order can also come from other sources, and that money order can come from things like the post office. The post office sells money orders too. And again, they're kind of like a cashier's check. You give an amount in cash to either the bank or the person selling the money order over to the post office, for example, plus an additional amount, and they'll give you this money order, which looks like a check. And as a result of that, you can cash it anywhere because of the fact, and it's trusted because it's drawn either on that bank or on the entity such as the United States Postal Service, which you know when you cash it, they're going to be able to be good for the money. Now, who are the parties for these negotiable instruments? They can be a natural person, a human being. They can be an artificial person, like a corporation, because corporations can have bank accounts too. They can sometimes be things like a government agency too. They can issue checks. When I worked as a counsel in the Senate, I got a paycheck every 2 weeks from the office of the state controller, who paid up all, you know, from the state of New York, which paid out the state of New York's not, it's a state, it's a governmental entity, it's not a corporation, but they issued a paycheck to me every 2 weeks. And when you get a tax refund, for example, the state of New York will send you a check, usually drawn on their account from the state controller. So one of those negotiable instruments can be from any of those three people. It can be from a natural person, a corporation, or an unincorporated enterprise, such as a government agency or a state or something like that. The parties for a negotiable instrument, for notes, as we said, they are the two parties, the maker, the creator of the note, and the payee, the person to whom the note is going to be paid. For drafts and checks, you have three parties. You have the drawer, who is the person who creates the check. You have the drawee, that's from where the funds come. That would principally be the bank, for example, or the entity, if it's a draft, from whom is the payment is going to be made. And thirdly, you have the payee, the person to whom is going to collect the money that you have designated. And that can be an individual person, as we said, or can be a bearer who's ever in possession of that. What's the maker? The maker is the party who creates the promissory note the CD and thereby promises to pay the amount specified in the note. The drawer is the person who creates the draft or the check. The drawee is the party to whom the draft is addressed and ordered to pay. And the payee is the person named in the instrument to receive the payment. Again, it can be a bearer instrument, so no payee is actually named. And that's going to be one of the subjects of our case tonight. We also can have an acceptor. That's the drawee of the draft, the person who's paying it. And when they accept liability, make the payment, they're called an acceptor. That's it for this section. Next, we're going to move on to the other areas of negotiable instruments. We're going to move into negotiability and how those factors and definitions come into play. See you next time. Thanks so much.